This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community devoted to these very themes. Hello. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today, we have a very special guest, one who has done more than any single person I know to change how we think about death, and she has used her wit, brilliance, and storytelling skills to encourage a more positive approach to mortality.
I am always and will always be a corpse girl. So for me, what actually happens to the physical dead body, how we treat it after death, how long we spend with the body after death, and then what we allow to happen to the bones or the corpse or parts of bones or whatever it is for me always going to be the most interesting thing.
Before we bring in our guest, let's enjoy a listener's story, question, or encounter revolving around death positivity.
Hi, my name is Emily, longtime Morbid Anatomy follower. When I heard this prompt to share a story about death, it made me think about when I was in my early 30s, I was friends with this guy in his early 80s. I used to work for him, but then over the years, we just became really close friends and spent a lot of time together, especially in his later years. And then he got really sick and the sickness progressed pretty quickly. And one day his daughter called me and said, you know, I think we're coming to the end if you want to come by and see him one last time. So I did. I went to go see him and he was in his bed, eyes closed, not really responding to the world, not interacting. And when I walked in, I greeted him and gave him a big hello and this huge smile spread across his face. And it was just so clear that he knew it was me and knew I was there with him. And I just cherished that as a sign that like these bonds of friendship that we had worked so hard to build were crossing over with him and that, you know, they expanded across into the gray area. And it was just a moment that I really hold dear to me. Thanks so much for all that you guys do. Can't wait to hear the podcast.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Today, I'm delighted to be welcoming Caitlin Doherty. Caitlin Doherty is a mortician, writer, and advocate for funeral industry reform and death acceptance. In 2011, she founded the nonprofit Order of the Good Death, of which I am a proud member, and which helped inspire the death positive movement. Her Ask a Mortician YouTube shorts have been viewed over 250 million times, and her three informative and also very funny books, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, From Here to Eternity, and Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs, are all New York Times bestsellers. Caitlin is a tireless death advocate in both cultural and political arenas, where she works to change public perception of death and foster conversation around mortality. She has also been a part of the Morbid Anatomy community from the very beginning. She contributed one of the essays in our Morbid Anatomy anthology. She joined us for our most eventful annual Day of the Dead trips, where we got lost on the island on our way to Lake Patscuaro, right?
Listen, I was just like, I'm along for the ride. It was scary, but it was also the liminal space between life and death. So I just was comfortable going along with it. I remember there being fog.
I felt like if we had wanted to give anyone an experience of what Day of the Dead stood for, that's what we inadvertently did. And she also wrote about this experience in one of her wonderful books. She's also given lots of talks at her various iterations. And on a personal level, I find her work a constant inspiration. And the world of death is so lucky to have her. Welcome, Caitlin.
What an introduction. Thank you, Joanna. Happy to be here.
Oh, well, it's totally true. I think you have done more than any other person I know to change both personal, cultural, ideas around death, as well as agitating for political change. And I'm so impressed by what you do and your tenacity and your sense of humor in the face of what I can only imagine at times can be thankless work.
That is so kind. That means a lot coming from you, since I remember being 25, just graduated college and coming to New York, and Morbid Anatomy was like a pilgrimage. And I remember coming to see you and feeling, of course, intimidated by you. But like looking back at that email, which I did a couple of years ago, it was just a wild email. I was just like, here's the reform, like that only someone in their mid-20s can send, you know, like, here's the reforms I'm going to do. No credentials that I had at all. But you really, like, this group of people that I started working with, including you at the very beginning, I still have so many people that I admire and who are still doing the work and were doing the work when it truly was thankless. And attention and reform and genuine conversation was kind of thin on the ground. And that was a really exciting time to be starting this work. So I think, you know, I appreciate you saying that, but I feel like we were all in the trenches at the beginning of our particular iteration of death awareness that has, as we will talk about, has been seen many times before. But in this new iteration, it was just a really exciting time to be in the trenches. Yeah.
No, I think you really beautifully encapsulated that. And it is still a scene of many of the same people in there, which is also really cool, I think. And that actually leads me to my first question, which is, you know, you started in university as a medieval studies scholar, and I'm really wondering how you got from there to death work, and if this was already something you had planned, or how did this happen?
I think I was actually thinking about this last night, interestingly enough. I'm reading a book called Life Work by Donald Hall, who is a poet. And this is a really fascinating, slim little book that I recommend. But it got me thinking about living in San Francisco after I had gotten my medieval studies degree. And I knew I didn't want to and maybe didn't even have the chops for deep cut academic work. And being just really confused about what I wanted to do and streaming America's Next Top Model and eating ramen and working in theater and just really not being sure, knowing that I was so fascinated by death and the history of the dead body throughout the centuries. And that's what I had done in my studies, but I just wasn't sure what I wanted to do with that. And then I wish this was a sexier story, actually, but truly, I just, at one day, I was like, I want to go work in a crematory. I want to see what I've studied historically put into practice in a modern American context and see what's really going on behind the scenes. And so I just worked very hard to be able to get a job at a crematory, and I did get a job at a crematory, and I started being the one back there actually cremating the dead bodies and processing the bones and turning them to ash. And almost instantly, something locked into place. And that something was, this is so strange. This modern American death system is so strangely set up. It's so strangely distant. It's so uncanny. And it's so rich. There's just so much here that has not been engaged by the public in quite a long time. And it just played into my fascination with the history of the corpse, because here we were at our most, you know, our closest iteration of what we do with the dead body. And most people have no idea what's going on behind there and what actually their power is around taking care of the dead body. And long story short, from there, I got into the scene that was happening in Northern California at the time, which was the start of return to very ancient traditions like green burial and family-led death care, where you take care of the body yourself. And those immediately appealed to me. And from there, it just kind of became the work that I did, was to work on this reform. And I'm actually extremely lucky, because this was not a hard won advocacy, in the sense of when I started, almost immediately it was kind of like a lightning bolt. And I was like, well, this is what I do. And of course, you still have the person in their mid-20s who has a diluted sense of what they can accomplish, which was very much, very much present. But I am extremely lucky in that I knew almost immediately that this was the work that I wanted to do and in my most deluded times was meant to do.
And what were your biggest, I mean, you kind of alluded talking about how uncanny it was, and you kind of talked a little bit about your feelings about where we could improve, but can you talk a little more specifically about what you encountered doing this kind of work? What really surprised you and what kind of compelled you to want to make changes?
Well, I'll say that working at a modern crematory is an intense experience. It's two big industrial ovens run by natural gas that you're feeding in, you know, several bodies every day, not at once. We do them all separately for those listening, but just this heat, like giant industrial pizza ovens that were processing the dead. And it's not necessarily the method of cremation that's bad in any way. It's a choice that the vast majority of people around the world now make, especially in the United States and the UK. But it was that it was just me by myself back there. Mm. It was one, and this was when I was even younger. I was 23. It was just this random 23-year-old girl with a degree in medieval history hauling these bodies and grinding their bones and getting dust on my face from this work. And why was this me? Especially since the body, the actual corpses themselves were doing so much for me in a strange way. They were doing this kind of emotional labor for me in this strange way where I just felt like I learned so much about myself and the world by reflecting on the realness of the death that I was seeing in front of me. I was seeing these dead bodies and there they were, and they were so real, and death was so real and so present in a way that it had never been before. Even with all my studies, my head in the books, it was never real for me the way it was actually being around all these dead bodies every day and having that kind of respectful, caring interaction with them. And so the question after all of this was, so nobody else gets this? Hmm. Somebody dies and it's treated as an emergency and we have to call someone immediately and the funeral home rushes over to come pick the person up and take them away and they never see their person again. And all of the care and all of the good stuff that a corpse can give you goes all to one random 23-year-old woman in the back of a crematory. That didn't seem like the right distribution to me. Yeah. And I say this even now when I think about people who burn out working in the funeral industry. I think a lot of times it's because the corpse distribution system is wrong in our culture. Like one person will have, you know, 30 corpses, or if you're a funeral director, hundreds of corpses. And then the family member who are actually mourning these people don't have any.
Yeah.
And no connection to the death and no connection to the ritual process of death. And so I think that was, I've never actually quite said it that way before, but I think that was the thing that really hit me, was just like the distribution here of how we are handling death and the actual physical dead body is there's a spanner in the wheel and it's wrong.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting how you're talking about it. The, like the working with the corpses gave you a certain gift that should be part of the closure process, is what I'm hearing you say, or could be at least usefully and always historically was a part of the closure process. And now is just your coming to terms with mortality and learning about yourself. And not that that's bad, but I just hadn't thought about it the way you're talking about it.
I was grateful for it. I was grateful for all of those dead bodies. I just didn't need or deserve all of
them.
You
wanted to share it, is what I feel like. And so that led to the writing of your first book, probably, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. That came from a kind of desire to share this experience with others on some level and get people to see the value of it.
Correct. Yeah. The first book that I wrote, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, was largely written from notes and diaries from that first year when I was 23 years old at a crematory. And I remember one comment when the book first came out was, why do we need a memoir that was mostly written when someone was 23? And the answer is that, like, it's all the warts and all of being a 23-year-old coming into a sense of your own mortality. You know, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes is not the book about death that I would write now. And it would be worse for it if I wrote it now, because part of what makes it, why it still has an impact, I think, is because it is, you know, I ended up, I think, officially writing it probably when I was 29, but based on all these old diaries, like, that's part of what makes it interesting, is that so many people have this first, and that's a good question, if I'm allowed to throw it back at you too, is when would you say was your real awakening around death? Because I feel very grateful that I have this document of, like, my awakening of what death really is and the work that I could do. Do you have something like that?
It's a great question. I don't think I have a moment like that. I think for me, it was more like, you know, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And, like, even when I was a little kid, I remember just thinking, wow, like, everyone has sex and everyone's going to die. And we all walk around pretending these things aren't true. So even when I was a little kid, it just felt so weird that these two big issues were, like, ignored. And I would just trip out on adults all the time. And then I guess what galvanized that into the Morbid Anatomy Project, into looking at it, you know, through the lens of material culture and art, was going to Europe for the first time right after I graduated college and going to all these museums and churches and seeing artworks, the likes of which I had never seen before. And I was an avid art historian. I loved art. And seeing objects like decaying Christs made of wax, or little, you know, gallivanting skeletons from the 17th century, or even the death's heads with the bat wings that you see in, like, every German church, it just really hit me. You know, I had been studying intellectual history in college, which is basically looking at the cultural products of a time to understand the time, and then also looking at our, through our own reactions, at how much we might have changed since then. And so looking at all this stuff and thinking, wow, clearly this was once really common, and now we think of it as morbid. So what has changed? And so I think that started the kind of more focused body of work that Morbid Anatomy has become, was that experience. But the very visceral feeling that death was something that was not talked about and that it was a really important central problem was something I always had in some way in my mind. Did you have anything like that when you were a kid?
Well, I think so, but I wonder what it is. I could have just run a big funeral home or gone into academia, or you could have, which I did run, not a huge funeral home, but, you know, or you could have done made art or also done academia. And I just wonder what the impulse is in certain people for translation to the public. I think that what people actually really relate to is if someone have just this, like, very deep, abiding intellectual desire and passion for certain parts of the history of the dead body, the intellectual history of the dead body, the art, the care of the dead throughout history. And if we can use that as a vehicle to translate our history of our relationship with mortality, the project here is not just like death. It's bad to talk about, but you can. It's like, hey, look back 50, 100, 150, 1,000, 2,000, like any time in history, and see all of these examples of how it wasn't related to in the way, like, our modern death denial industrial capitalist culture is very unique and weird. Like, we are living in the weird, unique part right now. And if you give people context for that, I think that's the best way to get across that their feelings are okay.
Yeah. You know, one thing I'm hearing in what you're talking about is something that I think about my own work. And I think for you too, there, and I think that's an interesting question you're asking. And I hadn't really asked it, like, why were we not just content to be like, okay, we've learned a lot and that's awesome. And now we're going to put that into our life and live some life. But we really want to bring the knowledge and wisdom that we feel that we've accrued to others. And I feel, I always think that's kind of like bridging, you know, like creating a bridge between this content that, as you were kind of alluding to, talking about academia, is often so inaccessible and difficult, you know, and trying to also reproduce the experience we had, I think, also of learning about this history. And it's not that the 19th century was morbid. It's that we have become such a different set of humans that we almost can't even look at the historical record without thinking, oh my God, what is wrong with these people, right? But that's something very unique to our time and place. And I think the other thing that you and I share is a love of travel. And I think when one travels, one sees that very, very undeniably. One learns in their bones that there are many, many other ways. And, you know, for me, spending a lot of time in Mexico and other places in Latin America really got me thinking, if I was born here and grew up here, I would probably not be afraid of death. And then thinking about what that meant to be born in the particular time and place that we were born. And I know in your book, your second book, From Here to Eternity, right?
Yeah.
You really go into this idea. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and how you decided to write that book.
Something that you just said that perked my ears up is that you felt it, you felt it in your bones when you traveled. And I think especially with Latin America, it's like you don't even have to feel it in your bones. You can see it in other people's bones because you can visually see the bones of dead people. The casualness and the like embodiedness with which you can just go through a cemetery and see death in its truest form is just a completely different experience. And it's fascinating because obviously geographically we're very close here in the United States to Latin America. It's not like we're going to some far off foreign lands where you take ocean vessels and trains and, you know, to get to. This is someplace very close with a culture. And I think that's another thing that when you go to different places, I found this in rural Indonesia, you find this in Latin America, the people that you're talking to and working with and are maybe driving you or translating for you, or you just become friends with, they're all on their cell phones. They're all on Facebook and Instagram. They're all getting energy drinks. They're smoking cigarettes. They're watching the news. Like, we're all doing the exact same things in our global culture now. And so the fact that we can all do the same things, except still treat death so differently, and have such a wildly different relationship with the actual dead body and what we do with the dead body continues to be fascinating to me. And Mexico specifically, and also in Bolivia, the continuance of indigenous ways of looking at the death as it comes together with Catholic ways of looking at the death, and the interest in bones and the continuing relationship you can have with bones in certain parts of the culture. I think for me specifically, obviously, we all know about Day of the Dead and the emotional continuation that gives death. And that is very, very important. It's important for grieving. It's important for engaging your mortality. But for me personally, I am always and will always be a corpse girl. So for me, what actually happens to the physical dead body, how we treat it after death, how long we spend with the body after death, and then what we allow to happen to the bones or the corpse or parts of bones or whatever it is for me always going to be the most interesting thing. So to go to like Pamuch, for example, and see places where they just have full mummies basically coming out of the grave and bones and piles of bones and things around the bones and gifts to the bones, I'm trying to describe what I feel when I think about it. It truly is the normalization of it that's so incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
It's the normalization and the casualness is not the right word, but just the integration and normalness of it does such incredible things for our perception of death. And I saw a thing in the Times about how this year Pamuche had like too many European tourists, you know, on actually when they did the bone cleaning. And that's really tough because on one hand, you do not want there to be too many tourists at this intimate ritual event that you do every year. But on the other hand, I feel bad for the Europeans who just, where are they getting this connection with death elsewhere? And I think that's a question you and I ask all the time, is how do we give people a true sense of death that we've gotten without encouraging them to like flood private spaces?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess we both have found ways to communicate that through, well, I'd say through words and images, because you also, you know, your YouTube work is so visual as well, right? So, and actually, you know, that makes me wonder, were you always interested in communication in that form, like writing, storytelling, communicating with an audience? Is that something you that was a big part of your life before you started doing this work?
I think so. Yes, I was always a writer, always in theater, always a bit of a performer. But I did see myself as someone who was going to be behind the scenes. I definitely didn't enter my 20s at any point thinking like it's going to be Caitlin out there in public. That was definitely not the goal. But as I moved more towards advocacy, you sort of. And I'm interested in how you feel about this because you and I have sort of gone different directions in how we do our advocacy and what we choose to focus on. But I think that we both have had to have a really finely tuned sense of what our greatest skills are and what works best for us at any given time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can try and deny that, and sometimes you can try and do something else. But at the end of the day, it always comes back to like certain things that are your best tools for advocacy. Yeah. And so it was 2011 when I started doing YouTube, and it was the same year that I founded the Order of the Good Death and got some people to do it with me just by sheer like a gumption, I guess. It was a time where I was just really throwing things at the wall, in a sense. I was just trying things. I was just seeing what, because I was writing essays and doing talks. I'm like, but what really works with people? What resonates with people? And so the first YouTube video I did was recorded on my MacBook camera and edited with iMovie, and is just the most like, talk about like found media, strange, you know, weird time of our past, like the piece of media. And it was just me answering questions about being a mortician. And it got picked up as like, this is a mortician telling you about your job. And this was, you know, this seems so quaint now because now on TikTok or whatever, we have literally everybody talking about their jobs at all times. And any job you can think of, there's 97 people who are full-time content creators about their whatever their weird job is. But at the time, there wasn't really that. Especially not for the death industry. And so that resonated pretty quickly. And then, you know, since then, that and writing books, I think there's a lot of behind the scenes work that goes on with, as you said, with like political things and organizing and that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, videos and books have been my two greatest mediums to just kind of reach out to people and be like, hey, here's this thing. Can I translate this to you in a way that makes you want to see death differently and see how you do death differently? Also, like in 2011, there was no such thing as like being a YouTuber. There was no such thing as like being a content creator. There was no such thing as being an influencer.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
You couldn't make money at any of these things. You couldn't do, you know, it started out for me purely as an advocacy tool because there was nothing else you could do with it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
There were no ads. There were no brand deals, like none of these things, and wasn't available for years into the process of making videos for me.
Yeah. And to piggyback on that, death wasn't very interesting to people back then. It was still pretty, I mean, now it's like such a different landscape. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that. But, you know, when I first started doing Morbid Anatomy in 2007, I didn't even want to use my real name because I was like, if my boss at Scholastic finds out that I'm doing this, I might get fired, right? It was not cool. And now I feel like it's gotten a bit cooler. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, to be fair, going to visit my friends in Brooklyn in my 20s and like going to a Morbid Anatomy event, to me, that was the height of cool.
Yeah.
Like I knew what was cool and that was it. So I think that like there are a large group of us who never had any question that was the cool thing to do.
That is absolutely true. Just to back up, could you kind of talk about the Order of the Good Death for those who don't know what it is, how you started it, what it did originally, what it does now, and also what inspired you to create an order, which is something I've always been, it's such an interesting model, but go ahead, that's a lot.
Well, no, I think that it was, because I had examples like Morbid Anatomy, the idea was, for me, because this is what I enjoyed, was an idea of bringing together, okay, there are people doing really interesting intellectual work around death and science around death, and then there are people working in the actual death industry with dead bodies, and it was sort of never the twain shall meet, but there were so many interesting projects that I could just, that I knew I would never be able to do myself, but that I could just conceive of as possible. And so the idea was that it was kind of a, originally, like a meeting place of people who were very similarly inclined about changing how we saw death, moving that forward, and working in an interdisciplinary way. I started it with a lot of my friends or people that I had managed to convince, you know, to kind of like, okay, I will reluctantly sign on to this. Over time became a nonprofit pretty quickly. Over the years, it's gone through different iterations, but at a certain point, I don't even know now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it became very attuned to actual legislative change, especially in the realm of legalizing human composting, which is the taking of the dead body down to soil, as opposed to taking the body down to bones with cremation, and aquamation, which is a kind of cremation that uses high heat water and a base chemical to dissolve the bones down. Those things all have to be legalized one by one in every individual United State and every country around the world. And sometimes within individual countries, they have their own provinces and it has to be legalized there. So it's just an extremely long process of working towards legalization. It's taught me a lot about working with legislation and working with government. But at the end of the day, our main purpose still is to show not necessarily the nitty-gritty, but like the possibility of ideas, the possibility of big ideas around death and what death can provide us, and the kind of just excitement that being attuned to your own death and having knowledge and power around your own death can give you, not only very practically when someone dies, but also just like what the future could possibly be. Like when we started this work, human composting was not a thing that existed. It was a little twinkle.
It was a vision.
And there are so many things that I think that we, you and I probably don't think about, but that have come up during our tenure doing this, that we've gotten to be a part of. And that's so, and that's like the coolest life also, you know.
I am not going to deny that. Every day I'm grateful that I get to do this work for a living and talk to people like you and delve deep into 100%. These topics and write about it and to have found an audience and a community without which we wouldn't be doing any of this.
Well, here's a question too. I think that you've probably seen this too. We've had, and you know, doing a sort of public advocacy or public organization life is definitely not for everyone. It has a lot of really good things about it and a lot of very difficult things about it, both existentially and financially and et cetera, et cetera.
Once you find your bone, you just keep, I mean, it's endlessly fascinating, right? Every time I give a talk on death, I always say and feel everything I said could go for like a mile more in any direction. You know, like there's just the richness of the material is so incredible. You could spend your whole life following just one path in the history of death and never get there. And there's so much, and it has so much to do with our sense of humanity, our sense of what a life well-lived is. And I think for me, and I wonder if this is the case for you as well, you know, by keeping death close at hand through the work we do and by constantly, you know, you've got your skull right there, being aware of the finitude of our time on Earth, it really helps you to clarify what it is you actually want to do before you die. And so you can die without deathbed regrets. I feel like that's really my main goal in life. And I feel like this is what my energy wants to do. Left to its own devices, this is what when I broke my foot, as I know we were in a lot of conversation when I broke my foot, I just worked on my book and I was very happy to do it and time disappeared. And if we want to be grandiose, maybe it is what we're supposed to be doing with our time on Earth to help others. And I also feel like, you know, what you were kind of talking about earlier about what you learned from those dead bodies, I kind of feel like I learned something similar from looking at the historical record and through my travel. And it's just so sad that everyone shouldn't have access to that just because they haven't had the exact experiences or the luxury to spend time thinking about those experiences that I might have had.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do wonder sometimes, first of all, we're not advocating that you break your foot or break your ankle like I did. But I will say, if you're trying to write a death book,
right?
you just got to sit there. It's not the worst thing in the world to get you started. I'm working on a book about Titanic now and have been for many years. And the book is about the dead bodies of Titanic and how we relate to death as a culture through Titanic. I think there is something that I wonder often, which is just as I am every single day picking through newspapers from 1912, yeah. picking through death records, doing this, the question for me is that it never gets old. So would this be too much death for another person? And we just have some way to like sit with the intensity of death at a way that not everyone has? Or is this a skill that everyone has and would benefit from? And I think what I ultimately come to is that what we want our work to do is to allow people to find that spark within themselves, related to the dead body, related to the history of death, related to the future of death, whatever it is, and be able to feel comfortable embracing that, sitting with that, and starting to do the work. And when I became more of a public figure around this, I had people say, you know, I want to do what you do. Tell me how I can do what you do. And my answer was, you can't do what I do, not in like a you could never do what I do sort of way. It's YouTube. Anybody could do that. But I think it really only works if you are speaking from your specific, abiding, intense passion that you have been able to unearth.
Yeah.
And that's the way that it translates and works. And by all means, and we've seen it happen. We've seen all these people around us find that for themselves and do absolutely incredible things with their specific work. That seems like it should be the goal for all of us, is to find that thing that clicks, that works, that drives us, and that we can spend, that we could break our foot and spend months doing nothing but.
Right, because it's such a pleasure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just want to kind of piggyback on what you're saying, that again, learning about this death stuff isn't just about facts, and it's not just about changing our perception or questioning how we think about the dead body, but it's also about changing our relationship to the finitude of our time on earth. And, you know, you were talking about the challenges of this road, and it's true, you know, like, I don't have a great retirement plan. You know, like, there's all these things that I haven't done that normal people have done. However, if I died tomorrow, I think I'd be, okay, I did what I wanted to do with my time on earth. And that's a really big shift. And I think that learning about these more material aspects of death helps us get there. And then once we get there, then we can live authentic lives that where we're doing the things we want to do with our time on earth. That's kind of part of, for me, wanting to share this, is to give people that as well, that freedom from fear and that freedom from that kind of sense before you have come to terms with your finitude of just like, well, what about that? And what about that? And what about that? Right? The sparkling sky of possibilities, and just coming back and, well, no, in your limited time on earth, what are you good at? What do you love? What are you willing to get up at 2 a.m. and talk about? And you're still going to be interested in it. What is that thing? That's the thing, right?
Well, also, I think it's sometimes easy for us to forget most people are afraid of death, and we're afraid of death in our own ways, of course, but like most people are living with a real shyness, I would say, around death, or like a little coquette at a debutante ball. They're like, oh, I don't know if I wish to step forward and see the corpse and all of its degradation and decay. You know, like they are very afraid of going to these places because, of course, society has put those barriers up and taught them that. I think that it's important to reflect on, and I'm doing that right now talking to you, just how incredible it is that we don't have that, that we get to lead with our curiosity at all times. And there is nothing, there is no feeling around death, nothing I won't approach, nothing I won't, you know, go once more into the breach to look at. And that doesn't mean that there's not moments of horror. It doesn't mean that like looking at Palestinian children or looking at, you know, the horrors of war or things that are happening in our own country or whatever it is not still horrifying and difficult in an existential way. But we have the tools to look at it and to face it and to address it. Really looking at death and really looking at the dead body in that sense, that's what gives you that power and that centeredness and the ability to move forward. So it's not only, like you're saying, it not only makes life easier and fun for you, it also makes life more like intense and realistic and honest for you.
Yeah, I totally agree, Caitlin. Thank you. I want to end with three questions I'm going to ask all my guests just to bring it back to our core themes. So I'm going to start with one. If you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
Hell no. 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 Absolutely not. No. It sounds so awful to me. Right now, you only need to look at the people who are striving to live forever.
Yes.
They are very wealthy. They are from the tech world. They are very male. They are very white. They have a certain sense of their own value in the world. And part of death acceptance is accepting, humbling yourself before the cruel truth of your own mortality and accepting that you are not that important. And in fact, your continued place on Earth is a burden for Earth. Earth is about regeneration. Every creature, all plants, all animals, all humans are part of a cycle of regeneration. And deciding that you want to subvert that and take yourself out of that because you yourself are more special is to me the most deluded thing that you could subscribe to. So, and also just like nothing means anything if it all goes on forever.
It's an open-ended question. I think it's really interesting to hear. I still meet a lot of students. I always ask my students this question, and there are people that do want to, and I'm always surprised, but I think it's a really interesting thought experiment.
You know that guy Brian Johnston, who's like the main, look him up. Okay. You'll actually like him, Joanna. He's, I will like him, quote unquote, he's the kind of life extension influencer main guy now. And why it's sort of interesting is that if you really go far enough down that path, you become like a Victorian weirdo. You know what I mean? The things that you do, the blood transfusions, the pills, the mushroom, you know, injection facials, the bath, like all the things that he's doing are so weird and so sci-fi. It's like H.G. Wells, you know, there's just so weird that it kind of comes around to being interesting again as a project. But just in general, someone who's like wealthy and is like, you know, inject virgin blood into me is very unappealing to me.
Agreed. Another question. Has your work changed your thoughts about death and what might or might not happen after?
I don't know. I've been now doing this since my very early 20s. So I've been doing it so long that I don't even really remember a world where my whole life and work wasn't death. But the interesting thing about death is that it's never over. And so my parents are going to die. My friends are going to die. People have died and that changed it. I've broken up with people and that's changed it. People have kids and that changed it. You lose your job and that changed. Death is just the breaking apart that death does and the grief that you have to go through changes your life each time it happens. Yeah. So if you are open to it and you don't see death as something that's happening to you and that's cruel and directed at you, but you're open to all of the grief that you're going to feel, that's a beautiful change that gets to happen in your life. And so my relationship with death has changed and will continue to change. And I have no idea where I'll end up. You know, I could end up at the end of my life believing extremely in an afterlife and believing in an interconnectedness of humanity and the world. I don't even know. And that's kind of what's exciting.
Yeah.
So I am where I am now, but like, who knows where I'm going? Death still has a lot to teach me.
Yes. And the final question I have is, how does the idea of death animate your life and work? But I don't know if there's anything to that specific question.
Yeah.
I know. I feel like that was 90
well,
minutes.
Okay. Well, here's it. Well, what I'll say is that I was extremely burnt out at a certain point, maybe 2 years ago, and I took a sabbatical, a 6-month sabbatical, which was very difficult to do. And I thought that it was going to be very difficult for everyone to lose me for that period of time, which, spoiler, was not at all. Also a good way to humble yourself. But I had a feeling, I was like, well, you know, once I step away from death, I'm going to be weaving upstate New York like flowers into a crown. I'm going to be very witchy. I'm going to change my whole life. I'm going to step away from death. And then in the silence, all that came back in its purest sense, was not like my desire to get back to bureaucracy or management of employees or any of that. All that came back was my desire to learn and research and talk about the history of the corpse. And I was like, right, this is where I started. This is what I want. This is what animates everything I do. And if I have a chance to start again with that as the core of everything that I do, that's what I want to do. And so that was a really nice, beautiful reminder and return to the thing that really animates my work.
I love that. Okay, finally, where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
I'm pretty easy. So if you do Caitlin, if you spell Caitlin correctly, C-A-I-T-L-I-N, and then you type in mortician, that's a good way to find me. Order of the Good Death. But I'm pretty easy to find. I won't be the most secretive guest that you interview.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Caitlin. It's been so wonderful to have you and to get to really find out more about what brought you to this place, because I don't think we've ever had this conversation before. So it was really great.
Thank you. Anytime. I'm so glad you're doing this.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm so happy to have you as a part of it.
I'll be back.
Okay, please.
Oh, Joanna, that was so good.
Oh, yeah, she's amazing, right?
So are you.
You're nice. Thank you. So after each episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to have a little chat and discuss our thoughts. And so here we are, after a really wonderful conversation with my old friend, Caitlin, and I'm going to bring it to Jess and say, Jess, you know, what stood out to you about what you heard? Was there anything new, surprising?
Well, first, I have to just say that it was an absolute fangirl dream come true for me to hear you and Caitlin in conversation as someone with an interest in death and talking about death, which, you know, in a lot of Western culture doesn't happen. You both are kind of, you know, peerheads of this. And so I just loved it. I loved that whole conversation. And there were so many interesting things to pick up on then. So there's all the obvious things about the interest in the body and the corpse in order to accept death. But something that I found really interesting as well that Caitlin mentioned earlier on was about burnout in the funeral industry and death workers because of the distribution. And in our culture, I just think that's a fascinating and really insightful take on it. If an average cremation worker has 30 corpses to care for and a funeral director has hundreds, and then the average person has zero contact, I just found that so powerful.
Yeah, I thought that was super interesting too. And also related to that, the idea that it's a set of gifts that people don't have access to simultaneously.
Yeah, it sounds like Caitlin has gained a great deal from working with the dead. It sounds like a really two-way street, which is ironic given that, you know, but it does seem that she has got so much out of that and clearly wants others. She wants to share in that, you know, which is, I think, where it comes in with the work that you do as well, in wanting to share and wanting to talk about that kind of thing.
Yeah, and take the fear away and demystify and make it more accessible for people to know that anyone can access this in some way.
Oh, it was also interesting what Caitlin was saying about because of our lack of exposure to death and lack of conversation about death in a lot of Western and European American culture, there is this kind of, there can be, you know, the tourism associated with cultures that are more open about it, and finding that balance between wanting people to explore, but also respecting the private spaces, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's definitely something I've seen a lot more in Mexico lately, is when we first started doing trips here for Day of the Dead, there was still a very healthy balance. And the last time we went to Oaxaca, which was last year, it felt like I don't want to be here anymore, because I feel like we're actually intruding on a special night of all of these people. Not just me, but the mass groups of Europeans and people from the United States who are hungry for experiences like this for very good reasons. But as she said, you know, you want to be very accepting of that, but too many is not good.
Yeah, I guess that too many observers as opposed to partakers, but there is something interesting there, isn't there, about what we can do to fill that need within our own practices. And I think that's a lot of what Morbid Anatomy does, you know, having death cafes where people can talk about these things and the lectures that you do. I think that gives that space.
And in the United States, Day of the Dead has also become really popular in a lot of cities that don't have Mexican or that have large Mexican populations and even beyond. And I think people have found these rituals useful and necessary in some way because we don't have any of our own. And I can see that some would call that cultural appropriation. But I also think there is some sort of it's not about profit. It's not about reclaiming or claiming as one's own. It's just about having access to a set of rituals and practices that allow us to have a better relationship with death.
100%. I really agree with that. And I have, like at home, I've made a little clay altar in the kind of the Day of the Dead style where I am kind of remembering my family, my ancestors. And that's bringing me like a lot of peace and joy, actually. And it's a really beautiful thing. So it's nice to kind of learn and implement these things into your own life.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com.
Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.